Right, hello and welcome to another episode of the Long Ball Football Podcast, a weekly podcast by two brothers about all things football in Portugal. You're listening to myself, Albert, and as always, I am joined by my brother Barney. How are you doing, Barney? How's things?
Yeah, good, mate. Not much to report. How are you?
Not bad. What do you mean, not much to report? It's been a crazy weekend.
Well, personally, yeah, personally, I went to a farm at the weekend. It was lovely. But...
No, this is actually one of the rare weekends where I did genuinely spend all weekend watching football. It's funny. Nice. I've had this conversation before because I didn't see my partner this weekend because she was busy. And it's funny, any time that I don't spend time with her, and I'm basically, this weekend I was left to my own devices. I just had all weekend to do whatever I want. And it turns out all I wanted to do was just watch football every day, which is what I did. So I watched a lot of Premier League football, and I watched the Premier League, and I went to watch Leyton Orient. And I play football as well. So, these kind of weekends where I don't see my friends, I don't see my family, it's like I'm confronted with the reality that I pretty much only have one interest.
I'm trying to work out a local place where I might be able to persuade them to sign up to Thriller TV. Show like some of the games.
A local bar or something.
Yeah, because, yeah, I mean, as a Catholic club, which is usually quite quiet, and I can imagine it maybe flying there. I certainly can imagine them putting on like a Benfica Europa League game, possibly, if I ask nicely. But with the derby of the weekend, I was just like, I saw it on Twitter. There was, is there a Benfica cafe in London where they were gonna watch the game?
Probably multiple, to be honest. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah. I need someone like that up here. Really, that'd be great.
Yeah, no, I know all the big clubs have. Fan clubs in London where you can go and watch the games. I've never actually been to one yet, so yeah, I need to think of a good opportunity to do that. I did play football the weekend on the Sunday, and I very satisfyingly scored the winning goal in a 3-2 game with my friends. So that was a nice feeling. There were a couple of, and this is a good link, Bonnie, and there were a couple of 3-2 games with last minute winners in the Premier League this weekend. Which we're going to come on to. There is, as I always say every week, Barney, there's an awful lot of football to discuss. We are, of course, going to cover Sporting versus Benfica, Porto versus Vitória, Braga versus Arouca, and a couple of games from the bottom end of the table. Plenty of stuff to discuss. But before we do, as always, a quick reminder that if you are a listener to the podcast, if you consider yourself a fan of Long Ball Football, thank you very much for listening. And if you would like, consider leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts or a star rating on Spotify. You could think about sending the podcast to a friend that you reckon might enjoy it, sharing the podcast on social media, or better yet, checking out our Patreon page where you can become a Long Ball Football socio for just £1 a month. I think it's a great time to do so because we're about to have another one of our Monday Night Football watch-alongs in the next couple of weeks. So if you sign up now, you'll be able to join us for that. So a link to that is in the description of this episode. But there's only one place we're going to start, Barney, of course. And I think it's fair to say that there hasn't been a bigger game all season as Sporting hosted Benfica at the Estadio José Alvalade. Before the game, just 1 point separated the two sides, although Sporting had a game in hand over Benfica. The narrative before the game from ourselves and many others was very much that a win for Sporting would all but guarantee them the Premier League title for this season. And equally, that nothing but a win was good enough for Benfica if they were to keep their own title hopes alive. So plenty at stake, combined with the fact that this is one of the biggest derbies in Portugal, set it up for being a huge, huge game. And we were not disappointed at all. Sporting opened the scoring with less than a minute played when Pedro Gonçalves, starting his first game after a recent injury, did some great work on the left wing to get into the box and put on a cross for Jenny Catalmo, who opened the scoring. Benfica responded pretty well to going behind. They put pressure on Sporting for the rest of the first half, and it paid off on the stroke of half time with Alexander Barr heading in from Angel Di Maria's free kick. The second half was much more of the same end-to-end stuff, both teams having their moments. But as the game headed towards a draw, Sporting got a corner, which dropped to Jenny Katamo, who rifled his shot into the Benfica net for his second goal of the night, giving his team all 3 points and surely putting Sporting in an incredibly strong position in terms of winning the title. We predicted that this would be a good game, Barney. I have to say, after the Taça de Portugal game in midweek where Benfica looked a better side, I wondered whether they would be able to get one better than Sporting in this game. But Amorim did something in this game that he didn't do in the Cup. He started Jenny Katamo on the wing ahead of Ishgaio. And what an inspired decision that turned out to be.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. As you described, that Benfica were... looked a better team in the Taça de Portugal game. And for Amorim to adapt, and as you say, bring Jenny Katamo in for his guy, whether that was always going to be the plan or whether he realised, you know, his guy is sort of going maybe defensively sounder than Katamo. You know, it's such a unique... He's such a unique player, Jenny Katamo, in so many ways. You know, we've seen wingers been moulded as fullbacks before, but not I can't remember seeing a left-footed player be molded into a right wing back. I find it so interesting. I mean, firstly, when you take that profile of player, I was thinking, like, it's essentially thinking, all right, I've got someone like Marcus Edwards and I'm gonna make him a right wing back. Like, to have that thought and to do it, and it just creates so many problems. You know, Alisson's in that left-back position, he was there to be attacked because, you know, if Alisson doesn't have many weaknesses, but one of his weaknesses in duels, and I think in the end of the game, Jenny won 9 out of the 11 duels he had with Alisson, which shows you, like, the effect he had in this game. He's had a remarkable journey. You know, think about, you know, coming from Mozambique, which hasn't historically produced many footballers, and his time at Sporting was a little, like... Well, he's had a few loan spells, he's had a few injuries. And then suddenly, you know, one of the things in the build-up to this game, which I was maybe a little surprised about, to be honest, was people... Did you see as well on Twitter, people were doing a lot of their combined 11s for Benfica Sporting? And Jenny Katamo was actually in a lot of people's 11s. And I think that just shows you how good he's been. Going back to the left-footed thing as a right wing-back, which I've spoken about this before, about Sporting and the fact that they have an abnormal amount of left-footed players, and whether that is like a... It's Rafael Nadal, isn't it, who specifically to play tennis left-handed as a sort of a little gain. I can't remember. Is that same story true of Lionel Messi playing left? I can't remember if that is the same. But
I'm not sure.
I think the point I'm making is it's a really interesting position for him to play, and he's doing so well at it. He's so positive. And his, you know, the first goal fell quite nicely for him. The winner in that moment of the game on his weak foot, rifling it in, is an incredible finish. And, you know, so many people would have crumbled, because I thought this game, we did see moments of nervousness from quite a lot of players. You know, there was good build-ups and passages of play, but the final ball, the finish wasn't quite there from a lot of players. But for Jenny Katamo to do that at that moment is a huge... moment for Sporting and a huge moment for him, and it was just seeing the tears as well was beautiful. You know, this is football, this is what we love, and yeah, it was amazing.
Yeah, it was... I mean, it's such a cliche, but I think it was a fairy tale moment for him. And you know, I was thinking about his inclusion in the side, and also Pedro Gonçalves. And I think it was, you know, the Taça de Portugal game during the week was such an interesting dress rehearsal, and it taught both sides a lot of things. For Benfica, it did teach them that, you know, because I thought Benfica were the better team in the cup game, if I'm being honest. And I think they would have learned from that game that basically if they can be more clinical, then they can cause Sporting real problems, and they have the ability to score multiple goals against Sporting. For Sporting, I think what the cup game showed, and specifically what it showed Ruben Amorim, was that being understandably slightly more cautious and defensive, which is what I think they did in the cup game, wasn't the way to win that game of football. They had to go out and try and cause Benfica as many of their own problems as they could, not to let them settle, not to let them get into in rhythm. And I think the risk of putting Pedro Gonçalves back in the team ahead of Paulinho, who was actually really, really good in the cup, was a big part of that, because I think Pedro Gonçalves is a much more, you know, he's a dynamic player. He's an attacking player that can hurt defenders. And secondly, that big decision, choosing Jenny over Ricardo Esguiar, who actually came on in the second half of the cup game and made such a big difference. And, you know, while Esguiar offers you solidity and experience in big games, I think Amorim recognised that he had to trust this young player who has performed so well for him this season, and that in the biggest game of the season and the biggest game of this player's career, he would still be an influential player. And obviously, I don't think he quite expected Jenny to score two goals in the manner that he did and make himself the hero of the game. But I think what's happened, and you know, and what a moment for Jenny, what a moment for the club and the fans. And I think it all comes down to, for me, Amorim's decision to go into this game and say, today we are going to approach this game by saying, we are going to be the top dog today. We are going to be in charge. We have the best players. I'm not going to focus on how to stop Benfica. I'm going to focus on putting out of a team whereby Benfica won't be able to stop us. I think that was the biggest decision made in this game by Amorim. Because, like I said, understandably, he made choices in the cup game, like putting Esguiar in for that experience, for that defensive solidity. Perfectly valid decisions to make. Even choosing Paulinho up front, an experienced player, a leader. These are all perfectly valid decisions. But I think Amorim recognised that if Sporting were going to win this game and if they're going to win the league, it was about time that they said, we are going to do this by going out and being the best team and being the best team in the league and showing why we are the best team in the league. And I think that's exactly what they did.
I think that Pedro Gonçalves moment that you mentioned at the beginning also has a huge amount of importance as well, because, you know, like, that is a real bit of magic to create that goal. I know it wasn't like a perfect assist. It sort of came through eventually to Casemiro, but to get around those two players, was it Florentino and Bar? Like, you know, it was...
Yeah. In the first minute of the game,
he's nowhere near his best, but you know that is a big moment. Even though it's the first minute of the game, that is a huge moment, and it sets the tone for the rest of the game. You know, it gives him a bit of stability. I thought St. Juiced as well, but you know, think about how much we've talked about Diamande and Kresma, who have been very good, but seeing him in the team and his pace was vital up against Neres. You know there was a lot more space for Neres to get into with Jenny Casemiro playing right wing back. And there was a few times where St. Juiced matched him for pace, and that was really important. And finally, Coates, you know, talk about players stepping up in big games. Huge once again. I just felt... And sort of compare it to, you know, to compare it to some of the Benfica players, Rafa, who I've spoken about so much this season, and if people listen to this podcast when we first started a few years ago, I've been on quite a journey on my feelings of Rafa. I'm now coming around to the idea that he is just a flat track bully, isn't he? And in these big games, it's quite rare that we see him do something special. And Alisson as well, having a bad game, as I mentioned, you know, not the best from him. So to see those players not step up and compared to, say, some of the Sporting players was quite an obvious difference.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to look at the game from Benfica's perspective, because I think you're right to say that perhaps their biggest players didn't have the best game. I slightly disagree on Alisson, if I'm being honest. I think he had a really tough day of it, and I think he just had a lot to do. I think for a player like Alisson in this game, it's easy for him to look worse than the other players, because I think he was just involved so much on that wing in those one-on-one duels, and actually he wasn't too bad. Obviously, look, this is a really disappointing loss for them, and I think it does basically put a nail in the coffin of any title hopes that they had left, even though I think most Benfica fans weren't particularly convinced that they had any before the game anyway. But outside of that wider context, I thought the game itself was largely even, and I think Benfica did play pretty well. You know, they did create multiple chances of their own. They didn't create, you know, necessarily more or less chances than Sporting. I thought they created about the same. I don't think they looked inferior to Sporting. particularly. I think it was actually quite a close game between two good teams, but this time fate dictated that Sporting were gonna be the ones to have that fairy tale moment, and Benfica were left with nothing. And obviously, the result has negative ramifications on Benfica's season, especially as you know this is means they won't really have any silverware to show for themselves this year. But I do think that if we're looking at the game of football itself, I think it wasn't that bad at all. I think it was pretty even, and just it wasn't their night, you know.
Coming in on that, what you mentioned about the sort of amount of chances created for both teams, that's been an underlying issue issue for Benfica, and underlying positive for Sporting all season. A few statistics for you, so Di Maria individually, to focus on him, has created 31 clear-cut opportunities this season. Out of those 31 clear-cut opportunities, only 8 have been converted. So that sort of shows you how poor they've been in front of goal, and you know, essentially Di Maria is having to sort of put the ball on the plate for people 3 times for every one goal. You know, that's not great. Compare that to Sporting, who have the biggest positive difference between XG and goals scored in the league. You know, Jenny's finish, for example, in this game, you know, that was a hell of a finish. But what we're seeing, Albert, is, you know, this is why Sporting are that bit further ahead than Benfica, is because they're scoring brilliant goals. Their players are finishing their chances, and for Benfica, that's been a real issue all season. It's interesting, Albert, because I feel like you were sort of perhaps didn't say it exactly like that, but are we in agreement that sort of this not has given the league Sporting, but it seems all but impossible for Benfica to close that gap, the momentum's with Sporting? Yeah, I don't know if you agree with that.
Yeah, no, I mean, look, mathematically, we can't say Sporting have won the league yet, but I think it would be almost harder for Sporting to lose the league from this position than it would be for them to win it, if that makes sense. You know, the balance of probability have shifted so heavily in their favour, 4 points ahead of their closest rival with a game in hand and a winnable game in hand at that. So I think that, I mean, until they win the game in hand and it moves to 7 points, then we can't call it a 7-point gap. But there's such a cushion now, and crucially, a team that it's not like they're limping through games. You know, it's not like they're crawling over the line in every game. They're playing really convincing, good football. They've got a squad full of fit players in good form. I just think, yeah, at this point, I'm sure Sporting fans won't want us to jinx it, but at this point, it comes down to the fact that for me, the balance of probability has shifted so that it's more likely that they win the league than they don't at this point in time, heavily, I would say.
I've seen a lot of different people sort of analysing the run-ins of both teams and sort of identifying fixtures where they might drop points. But I think the big thing really was, had this been a draw, they would have felt that bit more of a chance for Benfica. But the fact that, you know, that added 2-point difference the 3-point difference is just, yeah, it's too much for me. Finally, Albert, before we move on, I wasn't sure about mentioning it, but I thought Di Maria punching Pedro Gonçalves.
yeah.
It should have been a red, and I don't really understand. I do want to talk about refereeing in a bit later in other games, but I just felt that this was a bad call, and I felt like he was trying to make the game flow, and I commended for that. But then this is something that you can't really excuse.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And I think it's fortunate that that hasn't affected the result of the game, because I think if Benfica had won the match, then this would have been a much more heated talking point than what it is. It's one of those situations where everybody knows that it's not a real punch, in a sense that he's not punched someone in the face, as you know, in a way that you would in a fight. But the fact remains that in the laws of the game, he should have been sent off, and we see people sent off for exactly that incident all around the world in football. And so, yeah, but it's a strange one, because I think in the laws of the game, it should have been a sending off. And I am just relieved that it didn't ultimately affect the outcome of the game, because nobody wants another conversation about a refereeing mishap, which we might come on to in another game we're going to do, which affected an outcome of a game. So, I mean, I'm pleased that we can kind of leave that one there and just say, yeah, it probably should have been a red. But,
well, one thing it did help me realise in the aftermath, when I think Pedro Gonçalves had sort of jogged up the pitch and was in front of the Benfica bench, Luis Al was up giving it some. But then also Javi Martinez,
when
who
is
I
he
forgot
not?
was there. Like, he's still in Portugal.
Oh, mate.
Ex Boa Vista player. And yeah, that was a surprise.
And before we do another game, though, Barney, I did actually want to bring up how this result might affect the both sets of managers in this game. And I think we are looking at two managers in very different places right now. I think for Roger Schmidt, I think this could be a moment where he is now genuinely in trouble in terms of his position at Benfica, because as I mentioned, they're about to go a whole season without any silverware. That's not something that happens very often at Benfica. And when you combine it with the fact that they spent a lot of money on new players with varying degrees of success, they've not done anything particularly of note in Europe, and that throughout the season they haven't really been able to get rid of this kind of feeling of unrest that's kind of hung around the whole club and the fan base pretty much all season. And I think I'm just wondering, Brian, I think it would take a very trusting and very forgiving board to give him another season in the job. At this point in time, I think it comes down to the fact that Roger Schmidt needs to give the board a reason to kind of forgive this season. He needs to show them that he's really a manager that they need to believe in and give time to succeed. And I know he had a great first season in charge, but I'm just not necessarily sure there's enough there in Roger Schmidt where the board would really look at it and say, okay, well, we had a disappointing season this year, but we've got a great promising manager on our hands that we know if we nurture is going to come back to pay dividends. I just fear for him a bit because I don't think he's done enough really to keep his job in a situation where Benfica are going a whole season without any silverware after spending an awful lot of money.
I think there's a clear disconnect between himself and Rui Costa in terms of recruitment. We've seen a lot of players come in this summer and in the January window, players with prestige, with promise, with high potential, you could say. But what we're seeing on the pitch is a sort of Roger Schmidt having to use the players who most fit with his vision of the team. Look at the likes of Alcaraz playing left back from all the season, Tangstad getting the start in these two games as striker when they've spent close to 80 million on two strikers sitting on the bench. So I think that's been the clear issue this season as well. You can look at the left back, like I mentioned, left back situation. How many left backs have they signed this year? Three, and how many are playing? None. So yeah, I think that's the thing that's become in the forefront this season for me. That disconnect has not worked well for Benfica. So I think they're both equally to blame in the sense that you've got a manager not using the players that he's been bought for him, but also people buying players for him that he doesn't want necessarily. And then that's really let the team down. The way Koshy was been phased out as well, although partly the player's mistake is another example of like a really good player who perhaps should be playing. No, I can't see Schmidt's time continuing for long, I imagine. And it surprised me that I still see rumours of him being linked to other jobs, in a positive way rather than a negative way, like in Germany. And because it just seems so far away from last season where it was just amazing. And it seems hard to believe that just a few players leaving, like Gonzalo Ramos and Enzo Fernandez, can just completely change what's happened. So yeah, I can't see him staying next season. And yeah, I think people are getting a bit sick of it now.
Yeah, I think it is to do with the players that have just not fulfilled their potential, which is a real problem. I wrote down all the players they signed in this season, either in January or in the summer. And when you go through the list, Kochu, Arte Cabral, Marcos Leonardo, Jurasek, remember him? Anatoly Trubin, the goalkeeper, Presciani, young winger, Rollheiser, a young winger, Di Maria, Gonzalo Guedes, remember he came on loan and then his loan was terminated, Juan Bernat, the left back, and then Carreras, the other left back from Manchester United. And when you look at that list and you try and pick out which players have been a success, well, the goalkeeper, Trubin, I think, has definitely been an upgrade on Blakodimos. And Di Maria, I think, has been a success considering he was a free agent. But other than that, Kotchu, who really should have been a big success, and the way that's been handled has been really poor. Arte Cabral, who I think you know, I've suddenly found myself being an Article Brow apologist. I think there's something there with him. I think he could be a more than useful striker in this league. I think he could be a 20-goal a season striker in this league comfortably. Marcus Leonardo, who looked positive coming off the bench, but is just not getting any minutes. And yeah, after that, a whole host of signings, which, yeah, to put it, if you're being generous, like I said, varying degrees of success. But if we're being honest, mostly unsuccessful. And it's money spent, it's assets acquired that have just been wasted. And I'm not necessarily blaming the manager for that. But ultimately, I think the board will look at the situation and go, well, we either waste £100 million on all these players or we change the manager and hope to get a manager that will get more out of them. And I think that's probably the decision they'll make. Just quickly on Amorim, though, at the other end of the spectrum, I kind of alluded to my opinion already, but I'm coming around to the idea that this was probably the biggest game of his career so far, and probably the best game of his career so far as a manager. I test that. I think he passed with flying colours. His stock has never been higher, and actually we did see the firmest links to Liverpool that we've seen in a while. Maish Football, the website, reported it, and journalist Pedro Sepulveda reported that there has now been an official contact between Amorim and Liverpool. He has to take the next step at some point. I think we probably both agree that this summer is the right time. If he wins the league, then that's a fantastic season. But he actually has a chance of doing the double with the Taça de Portugal included, which would be fantastic and very doable, in my opinion. I think that at that point, at the end of the season, I think you have to say he really has achieved everything that he can in Portugal. I don't think there's any higher really that he can go without moving away. And it looks like there could be a very big job on the horizon for him.
Yeah, I mean, it's been fascinating to see the international interest come into him. As you mentioned, a lot more eyes would have been on this game, and at this point as well, where the rumors are increasing, you know, there was an impression on this game, and he absolutely delivered. I think he said in a sort of candid way, you know, if he doesn't win anything, he won't be leaving. I agree with everything you said there, but I don't know if perhaps we could have seen a bit more from him in Europe. I think that's been a bit of a disappointment, if that, to pick any negative. I cannot wait to see him at a different club. I think he's an excellent manager. We've just been criticizing the player development at Benfica. His player development is, you know, I can't think of many better examples of a manager improving young players. It's incredible what he's done. I'm really excited for him, and I think he's really proven himself this year after a sort of slightly difficult season last year. He's really bounced back and gone further. Really, he's certainly maturing as a manager, and we're seeing, you know, talked about at the beginning, the way he adapted his team from the dress rehearsal they had and how much better that made them. It was great to see. So yeah.
Yeah, I think he's showing this season that title winning year wasn't a one-hit wonder. You know, it wasn't just the planets aligning and a great squad landing in his lap. He's built this squad himself. He's developed the players. And I think he's on track to go one better than that title-winning season and getting a cup involved. And yeah, his stock is really high. Exciting times for Ruben Amorim in the future. Well, look, let's do another game. And there was a shock result in Porto as they fell to a second consecutive league defeat for the first time in a very long time. I wasn't able to verify exactly how long it's been since they lost two league games, but if anybody knows, please do let us know. But it was a shock result. Vitória won 2-1 at the Estádio do Dragão. We said, Barney, in our Patreon exclusive preview show that there was a game there to be won for Vitória. And they proved us right. It was a brilliant first half performance for Álvaro Pacheco's side. They went 2-0 up and really dominated the game. Porto did show, I thought, a lot of fight in the second half, where they got a goal back and looked to be in search of an equaliser. But it was a controversial red card for Captain Pep that seemed to take the wind out of their sails. And Vitória managed to hold on for a historic win. They're now just 2 points behind Porto in third place, on equal points with Braga in fourth. it's been a remarkable season for Vittorio Bianchi and a genuine possibility now that they could finish this season in third place. Bearing in mind, they started the season a bit of a shambles. They went through two managers very quickly before finally setting on Alvaro Pacheco. And the work that he has done with this team has been absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, we're in the same situation with the dress rehearsal in the week. And what I liked was Pacheco adapted from, like we've been talking about, Amarin. He mixed things up for this one, putting young Brazilian Cal George up top instead of Nelson Oliveira, which is a much more similar player to Andre Silva, and that really helped, you know, him and Jota. That bit of pace really exposed Cardozo, who got shipped off at halftime. And amazingly, I think that really highlights the difference Otavio for Porto makes to that Porto team. You know, think about a January's centre-back signing and how important he is to that team. I mean, yeah, like you said, Pacheco is... I think they're on course to get a record points total. They need like 6 more points in their last 7 games. Already more points than last season. And as you say, he only came into the job in October. It is really impressive. And helped amazingly by Jota Silva, who is really having that breakout season. I have always had my reservations about him. I think even as recently as a couple of weeks ago, where just because it felt like it took him a little while I wasn't sure he was going to be able to really take his game much further, but he has so much. And as I spoke about, I think, was it last time, or how I think it's interesting that I think the effect Pacheco would have helped in his development. You know, I compared it to what he did with Kiko Bondozo at Vizela. But looking just at the player himself, he deserves so much praise. His finishing is just, that's something I remember regularly criticizing at points of last season, and what, you know, the way he's on at the moment, it's incredible. Yeah, he deserves so much praise.
No, you know what? I totally get why people, including ourselves, have been perhaps a bit slow on the uptake with Jota, because I think it's fair to say that his improvement has been steep, right? It's been a steep over this season and last season. The way he has gone from an interesting, exciting talent at Casapia in the second division, taken on by Vitória to see if they can, you know, get a player good enough for the Primeira Liga. He makes his way into the Vitória first team. And again, the rise through the kind of the levels of ability that he's added to his game in a short space of time has been remarkable. Like you say, the finishing, a perfect example of a side to his game that he's improved in a short space of time, because as he showed in this game, his finishing is of a really high level. Do you know what? It's a funny thing, Barney, because do you know what struck me most about Jota Silva of the whole of this season was not actually even his performance in the game, which is post-match interview, where I looked at him and suddenly I saw that this guy is now the star at Vitória. He is the man. He is a leader on the pitch and off the pitch, and his mentality is fantastic. And I think I am now completely convinced that this guy has what it takes to play at a high level. I'm not saying he's necessarily going to be playing for Real Madrid, Manchester City, but he will play at a very high level. And I don't think this national team call-up is a flash in the pan. I think he's got all the attributes to play at top level, both psychologically and physically. He was the best player on the pitch out of both teams. And I think it's, you know, Vitória found themselves with a player who's probably exceeded even their wildest expectations.
Yeah, and you know, to look at other areas of the pitch as well that Pacheco's improved, obviously we can talk about the defence a few times, you know. Gasper as a player that's come back into the team and looked so good at right wing back. Midfield as well, Thomas Handel is developing really nicely. But yeah, I just think it's a huge moment, and the way that the celebrate afterward was really good to see. And I've got to be honest, like I hadn't been keeping as close an eye on the points situation to see where they are now in the table with Braga and Porto.
Listen, this
It's
is what I'm saying. People, they need to start looking over their shoulders at Vitória.
yeah, because you know the momentum's with them. And they're not the finished article as well. As I mentioned, you know, Pacho is still making tweaks to his lineup. I think I mentioned Nelson Oliveira. He had been starting quite a lot of the games, but that bringing in Carol George is looked like a really good move for this game and something that we might see again going forward. Yeah, he wasn't afraid to make changes as well throughout the game. You know, taking off was it João Mendes, who has been good in moments, but you know wasn't so good in this game. So yeah, it's absolutely brilliant for Vitória, and a great for them as a club. Like you know, we shouldn't forget because they are everyone will be very familiar with them. They're quite historically a prominent Portuguese club, but you know we can't be putting them in the same bracket as Porto or Benfica. You know, they're nowhere near, and so this is a big achievement, and they should be very proud.
Bonnie, there's a few things that we've got wrong on this podcast. One or two we've got right, but as everyone knows, we're always open about things that we've got wrong. And I think we both said at the beginning of the season that we thought Vitória were further away than they've been in a long time from closing the gap on Braga. And I think it's such a testament to the work that Álvaro Pacheco has done that he's got this team in the position that they are. Again, just to remind people, the beginning of the season, things looked bad. They went through two managers very quickly. They crashed out of the Europa Conference League. They looked in a bad place. And Pacheco has turned that team around in such a dramatic fashion. I mean, I'm gonna change the subject because I'm just banging on about the same thing. But it's been fantastic. We should consider the game from Porto's perspective, of course, though, Barney. We talked about a controversial non-red card in the Benfica game. I've got to get your opinion on this red card, which, as I mentioned, with the game at 2-1, Porto were looking to get back into it when Pep was sent off. It's actually quite hard to see what happened because the live cameras didn't pick up what happened, and there's various footage that's been released after the game. From what I can make out from the footage, and from what the referee was kind of gesturing with his hands afterwards, Pep was sent off a straight red card, not a second yellow, for making a sarcastic hand gesture towards, I think, the linesman and maybe the referee as well, more than once. The referee holds up two fingers, multiple, say like two times, like, right? Maybe I've told you two times, I told you two times, or something like that. But essentially, he's been sent off for the equivalent of perhaps clapping what he sees as a poor decision or something like that. You know, it's a sarcastic hand gesture that he's made at the referee. I will be honest with the listeners, I don't know what the rules of the game are with regards to this, but my instinct is that that feels harsh. Like, it does feel like a harsh reason to send off a player. Yellow card, absolutely. And maybe the listeners will disagree with me. Maybe this is just how it is. But to be honest, Bunny, I did think it was harsh.
Yeah, I think the image I've seen is that him doing either binoculars or glasses with his
Yes,
hands over the guy,
exactly that.
which I whether that can be classed as dissent, but for the straight, as you say, the straight red does seem quite harsh. Unless the referee's saying, because I saw you do it twice, that's two yellow card offenses. That's a red. I don't know. It does seem harsh, and this is why I brought up the Di Maria thing and the Benfica chat, because I do sort of understand, because Conceição after the game has sort of said, yeah, essentially said like why can that happen with Di Maria and then that happen with Pepe? That is an issue. I completely understand that there's different refs for different games, right? And which makes sense in terms of like when a ref might give out a yellow card compared to another ref, or when you know letting the game flow, etc. But when there is Pepe getting sent off for not even looking at this situation, but you know, the Mateus Reis punch back when they played Sporting towards the beginning of this year, and then Di Maria doesn't get that. That's clear inconsistencies with the refs in this league. You know, that's a rule that's not being adhered to in two separate occasions. And We spoke about it a bit last week, didn't we? Like, I can understand the frustration from everyone really in certain occasions for the standards of the refereeing. I also feel like there is a bit of like you're making a rod for your own back because it's like, do you know what I mean? Like, it does feel like Porto have fallen foul of harsh refereeing decisions, probably because they piss these referees off by complaining about them so much.
Well, do you know what? This is exactly what I was going to bring up, because there's another side to this loss, and I tweeted this out, and it's funny, if you're not following us on Twitter, go and follow us on Twitter, because how can I put it? It's not a sanitized Twitter feed. I do tweet what I think about games, it's not a great system if you're trying to amass large amounts of followers, because I do lose a lot of followers every time I kind of tweet my honest opinion about a team, as I did about Porto after this game, because I think Porto got an issue. I think they've got a big issue, and I think this game, and not only this game, but the loss against Estoril last weekend, it shows that they have, and this comes from the top down, a fundamental psychological weakness which will hold them back, undoubtedly. And that for me is that they simply cannot psychologically cope with a game that does not go their way, basically. For example, a game where they're playing a team which on paper they should beat, and unexpectedly they go behind, and they just cannot cope with it psychologically. It's like they just lose their focus, they lose their composure, the players start to regress into this more petulant kind of childish mindset. They start having a go at the ref, they start having a go at the officials, the people on the bench start getting involved, and it just kind of descends into this more kind of toxic atmosphere. When a psychologically strong team would go, right, we've gone 1-0 down at home against Vitória in a game we should be winning, let's pull our finger out and focus on winning the game, instead of, as you say, instead of pissing off the refs in a way that is probably going to create an atmosphere which doesn't benefit you. They don't benefit from an atmosphere where the referees are under pressure and facing hostility from players. The referees are human beings, and maybe if Porto had not descended to that level that they were, where there was a lot of aggravation and there was a lot of hostility, maybe the ref doesn't pull out the red card for Pep. Maybe that doesn't happen. I mean, I am obviously speculating, but this is just my honest opinion, and everyone's free to agree or disagree with me. You're free to unfollow me on Twitter if you want. I'll totally accept it. But I think this is a negative aspect to the current Porto side, which we have seen multiple times. I think there is evidence for this going back, not just this season, but last season. And why does a whole team kind of embody one mindset like that? For me, it comes from the top down. I think you do have to lay some blame at Conceição's door. Unfortunately, anyone who's listened to the show for a long time will know that I am one of the biggest Conceição supporters. I have gone on record to say I think he's the best manager in the league ahead of Amorim. I think he's given a lot to this Porto side, but I also think there is a negative side to Sergio Conceição, which is the mentality and the mindset. And I don't think he breeds a positive mindset with his teams.
Oh, there's another negative to Conceição and his man management. I was just because there was a few players in this game, Cardoso being one, who hasn't played since he got sent off against Arouca a while back, and just because he was shipped off at half time for a sort of poor performance, and then Zé Pedro was sent on, and I just felt for Zé Pedro because this is a player who came in, he was promoted from the B team out of necessity earlier in the season when they had so many injuries at centre back, but he played well and he's been shown no faith or appreciation from Conceição. As soon as like the players are back available, he's been dropped, and even to the point where he was dropped, not put ahead of Cardoso for this game, and then it was almost worse him coming on as a sub for him in a way. It was sort of to add insult to the situation he's in. I just thought that's a highlight of a sort of poor man management from Conceição there. And another one is Dani Lamasso, who
Oh,
sort of
man.
got a lot of criticism for essentially not being Evan Nilsson, not linking up well with Conceição and Galeno, but he's been so underused by Conceição and barely had any game time to sort of, let's say, build up these relationships. But not only that, when we have seen him play, he's been far better playing off a striker, you know, almost in a number 10 role, rather than the lone striker. So in that sense, why are you not playing Taremi, who did come on in this game but hasn't played for Porto since the Africa Cup of Nations, always all but confirmed as departing for Inter Milan? You know, there seems to be personal decisions being made rather than decisions being made for the good of the team, which are really affecting some individuals like Namasa and Cesc Pedro. So these things we've talked about a few times before, you know, even when we're discussing David Carmo back when he was here, yeah. You know, they're Conchisao was very ruthless. And I think there's been a few occasions this season where I felt like he's been too ruthless with individuals. But I think the point I'm trying to make, Albert, is that, you know, these decisions he's made, which I would lean towards saying are perhaps personal rather than actually making decisions for the best team to put out. If Taremi had started up top by himself, you know, I think this probably could have been a slightly different, maybe it's not so simple as that, but I think there was probably a better chance of them getting a goal or something. But yeah, it's and as we were talking about, you know, just to turn it back to Vitória are in a great position because, as we're going to talk about Braga in a second, you know, Braga and Porto are in two precarious situations and things are going from bad to worse. And whereas Vitória, things are getting better and better. And, you know, this is making for a really exciting, you know, running where I hope it stays as close as it is now.
Absolutely. Well, look, let's move on because we've spent a lot of time on those games and cover some more football from the Primeira Liga. And there was another surprise loss for one of the big clubs in the league as Braga lost their first game after Artur Jorge's departure 3-0 at home to Arouca. A really, really poor 3-0 home loss from Braga's perspective. But honestly, one of the best performances from Arouca that I've seen since we've been watching them. They completely ripped Braga apart in the first half. And genuinely, if you'd asked me, Barney, which of those two teams had been playing Champions League football earlier in the season, you could only have said it was Arouca based on that performance.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure what Daniel Sousa was doing if he wants Braga to get European football next season.
You know, does he want to be managing the Champions League or not?
Yeah. Needs to think a bit more ahead. No, look, it was, you know, two perfect moments, really, isn't it? Because we've, you know, the departure of Arthur Jorge and the sort of ending of Braga's season, if you will, last week. And then you've got the other hand where you've got Sousa with this amazing opportunity, great promotion in his career and real justification for the work he's done at Arouca and then a performance to sort of match that, you know. You know, we've seen him really work out his best 11 with Arouca now, with Mujica and Chris Gonzalez up front, Jason and Morlai Sidda. But the one I really like is Santos in midfield alongside Samau. I feel like it just balances out really well.
David Samau, Barney, for me, one of the most underrated players in this league. I'm starting the campaign here and now. Get Samau to Euro 2024. Who's with me?
Albert, I love this because usually I feel it's me falling in love with like an aged midfielder from one of the lower teams. But to see you completely fall in love with someone this year is great.
I'm gonna, do you know what, Barney? I'm gonna tweet that out now. Bear with me. You can speak it. Let's see how many people we can get on board before we finish recording this podcast.
Should I continue or should I wait to see how many?
You carry on. No, you carry on.
But then I was just, well, talking about his other partner in midfield, Pedro Santos, I just think he's looking really good a bit. He just offers something slightly different from Samuel. Samuel's always that classy touch. Pedro Santos has got that bit of, I don't know, more box to box, you might say, but also very skillful in himself. And that back line as well, Montero has been a great centre-back replacement for Puku, who we were such big fans of last season. But then Arabarrera had a fantastic game in this game as well. You know, just a nice reminder of what a quality keeper they have. You know, for a team of their size, you know, they're really lucky in that sense. Because, you know, to be fair to Braga, they did have their chances, you know, but it's the same old thing of as good as they are on attack defensively, they had their issues. And when you've got the likes of Mujica, who's on, I can't remember how many goals he's on, but he's right up there for top goal scorer award. And, you know, when you've got an attack like they formed at Arouca, you know, there was always going to be an issue for Braga.
Yeah, bear with me. I'm just hitting send on this tweet. get David somehow to hashtag Euro 2024. I'm going to tag Roberto Martinez.
Would you say he's got more chance of going than Jean Moutinho?
I hope so. So that's that point.
Or would you like to see a double pivot of Jean Moutinho?
And now you're talking my language, Roberto Martinez. All right, and send. Right, let's see how many people get on board the hype train before the end of the episode. you're spot on. I think it's a similar feeling to when we talk about Jota Silva. Is how far can they go and how much can they keep improving under Daniel Sousa? Because we've spoken about him so many times this season, and they continue to improve. For me, man of the match was Jason, who I think is probably the least fashionable of that front three. You know, there's that front three now, which has become infamous: Christo, Mujica, and Jason. But I think I just thought he was absolutely unreal on the day. His cross for the first goal was brilliant, and I thought he played really well throughout.
I think Jason is a prime example of why Arouca are having so much continued success, in the sense that he's a 29-year-old Spaniard who's, you know, flirted with the top and second division with Spain, and then has come over to Arouca, and under good good guidance from a good manager, is excelling in this league. But he's probably not a player who's going to get moved on or sold to another club. There's every chance that he could stay because, you know, like I said, he's 29. He's not got much of a pedigree, but it's working at Arouca. There's a similar situation for other players in that pitch. Or Morlaix as well might be one of those players that just never makes that jump, but he's a great player. And so I think that's why, you know, when we're talking, we're briefly talking a week personally about who might take the Arouca job, I think they're in a really strong position, and I think they might be next season because they're so good at finding out these gems of players, but then also having a decent manager to take them to that next level.
It's a shame for Braga and then Barney, obviously, to have such a poor performance at the stage of the season. We did question why they would have let their manager go with 6 games to go and plenty still to play for in terms of the league. There was no immediate replacement lined up, so hard to see any kind of new manager bounce happening. And obviously, we got the opposite, whereby, in my opinion, the team looked lost. It was the least organised that we've seen them all season, I think. I mean, maybe it's easy to say with the benefit of hindsight, but probably letting their manager go with no replacement was not in the best interest of the team at a fairly crucial part of the season.
Yeah, I think that's very questionable, although everything that's come out after his departure seems to suggest that it was not, they weren't entirely sure that it was going to happen, but Arteta's all but sort of forced it through. It's the balancing act, isn't it? Because, you know, if Arouca continue on the way they're going, who's to say that there wouldn't be bigger clubs coming in for Daniel Sousa out of the big three? So for Braga to get in early, it makes sense. But then, as you say, they're in this sort of limbo now for the rest of the season with the caretaker manager. But I think we've criticised the defence a lot this season. And then if you look at this back four for this game, Victor Gomez, Sarchi, Niakate and Mendes filling in at left back, although he's naturally a right back. That's a very young, inexperienced back line. And although it hasn't been that back line most of the season, you know, we shouldn't forget that there are young players. But I think the point that I'm really going to push is, and I've seen a few other fans do this now, is the disappointment of Mateus, who I feel has not been at his best. And when you've got such a experienced keeper as he is, you know, with such an inexperienced back line for this game, for example, you expect a bit more. Well, maybe that's an easy thing to say, but, you know, there needs to be some leadership and some guidance from him. And I don't think we've seen that. I think there's been a slight drop off from him this season, which hasn't helped their defensive record as well. Look, they've got to just really try and push the rest of the season. I think they lose defensive solidity in midfield as well, because there isn't that. They've lost Maserati, who is, you know, perhaps proving to be a bigger loss than we perhaps anticipated, but also, you know, try and guide the likes of Bruma and Roger Fernandez to sort of get those goals of them again, because yeah, they're their star players now.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Zero likes on my David Smell tweet so far, but I'm sure they'll come. I'm sure they'll come.
Does David Smell follow us?
he will soon. We've already covered a lot on this week's podcast, but we should have a look further down at the bottom of the table. Unfortunately, Barney, it was heartbreak for both of the league's bottom place sides as both Shavs and Vizela saw points slip away after losing games to late goals. Shavs hosted Portimonense and were 2-1 up until the 82nd minute, but crumbled in the late stages of the game and ended up losing 3-2. Their suffering was intensified somewhat by the fact that at 2-2, with 89 minutes played, they thought they'd scored the winner, only for it to be deemed offside, and Portimonense went down the other end of the pitch just a minute later and dealt them a killer blow with a thunderbolt goal from Igor Marquez to secure the win. It's, on the one hand, it's heartbreaking for Shavs as they needed a point so badly to lose in that way is so hard to take. But on the other hand, Barney, there was some dreadful defending from their part, and it is really hard to blame anyone other than themselves.
Yeah, it's been their issue all season. It was a really just such heartbreak for them. It's so not unfair, but it was just so harsh.
It was, man, honestly.
Yeah, I think the game's running up as for both of them and Vizela now. I can't. They've just, you know, teams have luck and they haven't had any. They've been playing poorly. Something we said quite a few times. Moreno hasn't been able to sort that defense out. He hasn't been able to sort his midfield out. You know, you look at the loan sign of Darius Asugo from Sporting, which I took initially as quite exciting, but I think I did that from the point of view as a, not a Sporting fan, but from the point of view as, you know, a young, exciting player getting minutes. Practically, I think, you know, that's been a bit of an error, because I think, although he's shown glimpses, you know, when you're in a relegation battle, you really need some experience. And they had players like that. I think Nkwali coming out of the team, a player who's showed that he's got quality on the ball and in possession and pressure, you know, that he's barely featured since Asugo's come in. So I think that's been a mistake. Moreno at the back as well, you know, there's been individual errors like there was in this game from Fernandez, you know, another player brought in, but yes, has sort of let them down. It's, yeah, terrible for Shabs. But then, you know, exciting for Portimonense, I think I can't have mentioned it in the preview show for the Patreon listeners, but I just had a sense that Portimonense is just that sort of team are just going to do this they will do this to you, you know, they'll break your hearts. they did not disappoint, because yeah, that winner was absolutely top draw. Was it? Is he a centre back as well for Miga? I've
never heard of him before he scored that goal, Barney, I'm going to be honest with you.
Yeah, I think he's a right back or a centre back, but like, what a hit! And why is he doing that? No, you know, just absolutely.
It's
ridiculous.
it's just the poetry of the fact that it's literally 60 seconds, almost on the dot, after Shavs have that header ruled out, and they go up the other end to do that. It's a Paolo Sergio masterclass, Barney. It's just nailed on that he's going to once again perform a great escape and keep Portimonense up, as he does every single season. And he really doesn't deserve our ridicule. He deserves our praise, but I'm going to ridicule him anyway. But listen, I respect it.
You're doing a disservice there by saying it's a great escape. They've been safely clear most of the season, I'd say. You know, they've been, well, not safely, but you know, they've been comfortable. There's another team struggling more than them. And look at I know I talk about too much. Maybe let's move on to the next game.
Let's move on. Because also Vizela fell to a similar fate as Shavs by losing to a last-minute goal against Famalicão. Now, Famalicão had actually taken a 2-0 lead in the game, but Vizela valiantly fought back to tie the game at 2-2, only for a last-minute winner from Jean de Cadiz to take all the wind out of their sails and undo all that good work they'd done to get back into the game. It's the same story as Shavs, Barney. For a team right down at the bottom of the table, they're going to have to start picking up points, they're going to have to start holding on to results if they're going to survive.
No, they did well to get back in the game. I've seen I've seen a lot of people talk about De La Barana, the Vizela manager, usually from quite a positive angle, and it feels like it reminds me of when the way people spoke about Mikel Arteta when he first started. You know, the fact that people were sort of saying, although they're not getting the results, they are playing a good brand of football, and you've got to trust the process. The problem with Vizela is that they're in the relegation battle, and I just think it's, you know, who knows? He might go down with them and bring up a great team, but they've just been, yeah, you know, to lose it like this in the last minute is not great, and I do have questions around the sort of some of the players that he's selecting over others. I mentioned that last week. To bring some positives to this game, I thought the performance of Chiquinho has been excellent recently. He's been a fantastic signing from Famalicão, a really good winger. Gustavo Sarr has been great, and Cadiz. That those are three really good players that have been playing so well for them. Similar with Vizela, there's players like Petrov, the striker, who's got a few goals now and sends with his sort of send sort of drying up in front of goal. You know, he's coming with a few. But yeah, I think to sort of go back to my first point, I just think, yeah, Vizela and Chaves are down now, but I think there's no way back for them now. And it makes that final spot a bit more interesting. And I don't know, maybe I'm being too negative, but I just can't see any way out for these two teams now.
Yeah. I think Chaves are in a worse position of the two, honestly. They look completely dead on their feet, and it's pretty hard to watch, to be honest with you. I'll just end on the fact that when I watched the highlights of the Famalicão Vizela game, and I saw Famalicão manager Armando Evangelista, formerly of Arouca, and I completely forgot that he was Famalicão manager. But you know, like similar to with Porto Melens, it's important for Famalicão to get good results because they've had a disappointing season where they've underperformed. I think it's important for them to finish the season strongly, to convince the fans, to convince the players that there's still a project at this club worth hanging around for, because next season is going to have to be very different for them.
I'm just so sorry to go back to Chiquinho, because it'd be very interesting to see if he comes back to Portugal next year and what sort of team he might attract interest from, him, because I think, you know, that move to Wolves was a bit of a fail. I can't remember where he went. Did he go and learn in the Championship and that didn't come off either? But for him to come back to Portugal and sort of, he looks better than him when he was at Estoril, I would say, in his performance for Famalicão this half of the season. So he's really, really good.
Yeah. All right. I think that is all we've got time for on this episode of the Long Ball Football Podcast. It's been a long episode with a lot covered. If you've listened all the way through, thank you very much for listening. As always, just a reminder to give us a rating on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, share the show on social media with your friends, and to check out our Patreon if you haven't done so already. Still no likes on my David Samal tweet, but I'm sure the hype train will keep moving. I might start a petition.
Do a couple of replies.
A couple of replies. Most people telling me I'm wrong. But we don't listen to the haters. on that note, I think we'll just say thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Yeah, see you next week.